This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, which means time for the Week in Review, beginning with the retirement of Boston Police Commissioner William Evans. This week, he credited his success to those who served under him.
Whether it's, you know, the Occupy Boston, the marathon bombing, the Black Lives Matter, the Charlottesville, and they've really shown this city proud. So I'm only as good as the people who I lead and have done a great job.
Mayor Marty Walsh wasted no time naming a successor. He tapped Superintendent-in-Chief William Gross as the next commissioner. Gross will be Boston's first ever person of color to lead BPD, a department he first joined in 1985.
Many calls from my mother worried because of the atmosphere at the time betwixt the communities and BPD. But if you want change, be the change. That's why I became a police officer.
Now, lots of praise for this pick, but some criticism as well. The Blackstonian's Jamal Crawford wanted more citizen input in the selection.
I think that what we miss here is a process, a community process. It would have been nice to have a pick from candidates, and I'm uncomfortable with them emerging from rank and file anyway because there's too many allegiances and relationships there.
All right, well, there's a lot to talk about. So let's turn to Joe Battenfeld. He's a Boston Herald political reporter and columnist. He also hosts Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, it's good to see you.
Thanks. Good to see you, Meghna.
Also with us is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, great to see you as well.
Thank you very much.
All right, so first of all, let's talk about William Evans retiring from Boston Police as commissioner. Joe, just your take on sort of his tenure and his career at BPD.
I mean, I think you could describe it as a successful career, but, you know, there are a lot of things undone as well. There's still a lot of distrust between the police community and the community at large. And, you know, as we've seen, or stories we're going to talk about later, I think, about the disparity in solving murders mm-hmm. between blacks and whites, you know, it certainly has a long way to go there. So I think, you know, he was very closely linked to Marty Walsh, very much in that kind of mold of a Mayor Walsh kind of person. And it seems like the new commissioner is also a Walsh guy, too. Yeah. So I think we're seeing it was kind of a no-brainer pick for Walsh to pick who he did because, you know, obviously for the historic reasons, the first black commissioner in the city's history, that looks good for Marty Walsh to do that. And it goes a long way toward bridging there still is a lot of distrust in the community. In the black community with the Walsh administration.
Yeah, and so we'll talk more about Gross here in just a second. But Tom, give me your take on Bill Evans.
I thought Evans was great, but brief. And I'm really surprised.
Four years
is not a long time to really head up, you know, to essentially hold the most prestigious job, one of the most prestigious jobs in law enforcement. I wonder why he really left. I mean, maybe it was that the allure of Boston College and higher salary and better hours just was overwhelming. And that's kind of what he said, that he would like to spend more time with his family. But still, this is the kind of position that you want to be in and where you affect long-term change by being in there for more than 4 years. Having said that, those were four good years. I mean, Boston, compare what happened with Boston's police department and the lack of drama compared to other police departments across the United States over the last 4 years. Evans kind of held things together.
Yeah, but you know, as Joe pointed out, we will talk about in a second the disparity in the homicide closure rates or clearance rates in a minute. But when we were looking back at Evans' leadership, you're right, there perhaps wasn't like a giant disaster or catastrophe that BPD had to deal with, but there's the continuing trust issues with the community. And we also noted that a lot of the times that Evans received some pushback for BPD policies had to do with things like surveillance, right? And using, you know, license plates, scanners, using social media surveillance, things like that. I just wonder if, is that indicative of BPD under Evans or just policing sort of where it is today in 2018?
It's indicative of policing. I really think it is. I think, I mean, Evans, to his credit, actually wanted to go forward with body cameras and is experimenting on that side. But police love the idea of more surveillance of scanners and so on. I'm sure they're going to love the idea of facial ID when it starts getting perfected down the road. This makes their job a lot easier.
I do think the timing was good. I don't know if Mayor Walsh may have politely suggested that it would be a good idea if Commissioner Evans took this BC job, or certainly didn't dissuade him from taking the BC job. But it certainly was good timing for Mayor Walsh. He was just got a lot of criticism for picking the school commissioner, who was a white woman, passed over, and he didn't go through any process at all. It is an interim pick, but it's widely believed to be, a permanent pick. And so he got criticism for that. So I think this was good timing for him in a way that he was able to pick the first black commissioner.
Yeah. And let's be clear, BC did not offer this job to Billy Evans without Marty Walsh being fully aware of it. So it was with Walsh's consent. So this is an engineered exit in some fashion. Didn't come out of the blue. It wasn't like, it's not like Evans was on LinkedIn looking for other jobs out there.
Yeah. And so then why did they get so mad when BZ scooped them on this?
especially with the Walsh administration, I can't tell you how many times they've denied things when we clearly know that we're reporting something that's correct, and they're still denying it anyway. And then 3 weeks later, it turns out, of course, oh, yeah, it was correct. But
part of it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's an all too common occurrence with public officials.
Yeah, all right. So let's talk in more depth about Superintendent-in-Chief William Gross. Again, he's going to be the next commissioner for Boston Police. He's been with BPD for more than 30 years, born here, served as a cadet, a beat officer, and then in command staff. And here's what he said on Monday about his vision for being commissioner.
My strategy is, if it's not broke, don't fix it. But we still have a vision that we're going to move forward. So under training, reviewing policy, procedures, best practices across the country, we're going to continue to move our department forward, and that can only be done with the communities.
Tom, what do you think?
So I think the big advantage with picking Gross, who, by the way, will be the most mispronounced last name in Boston. Let's just be clear about that. But the biggest advantage here is dealing with the trust issue that Joe had been talking about earlier. That is what he will be able to bring to the table in terms of being a man, being an African-American, being able to connect to the community, I think in a way that Evans never would have been able to, despite his best efforts. That will build up some trust. And the hope is that the stuff that gets fixed, and the trust is the big thing to get fixed, starts to result in better clearance rates on things like homicides.
Well, so, Joe, before I turn to you, let's just hear from Sheriff Stephen Tompkins, because on this point exactly, he told WBUR that he likes the message that Gross's selection sends.
This will send a message to not only the communities of color, but all kids, no matter the color of their skin, that if you work hard, you can achieve good things. And Willie has come up through the system, he's done it the right way, and he's been honored for that by Mayor Walsh.
And just earlier this week, we actually spoke with Mayor Marty Walsh about why he chose Superintendent Chief Gross, and the fact that, how important was it to him that Gross will be the first black police commissioner for Boston. Here's what he said.
I think I underestimated the emotional impact that I'm seeing out in the street of Chief Willie Gross. I was talking to a woman yesterday, African-American woman from New York, lives in Boston now for about 15 years, and she came out to me literally almost in tears saying this is her city now and how proud she was and of the impact. The impact is big.
Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, the symbolism can go a long way, but beyond the historic implications, I think what you have is a guy, Gross, who's very much a status quo guy.
Yeah.
He's come up through the ranks of the boss. He's not an outsider at all. He doesn't bring an outsider's perspective, and that's why I think it's a fair point to say, well, why did we have to rush into this? Why do we have to pick someone immediately on this very same... Evans didn't even get a chance to have a farewell press conference. It was the same, very same press conference that they introduced Gross. So I think it's a fair point to say, well, couldn't we have waited a couple weeks? Couldn't we have involved the community? Couldn't we have maybe looked at an outsider to come in and maybe gone in a different direction, a bold new direction? Because this isn't a bold choice. It's an historic choice, but not a bold one.
Tom, what do you think?
I really disagree. I think Walsh did the right thing in this case. If crime goes up, I'm not blaming the commissioner. I'm going to blame the mayor. And the mayor needs to know he has trust in the person who is heading up his law enforcement apparatus. He clearly has trust in Gross. I also have to tell you that politically, this worked out beautifully for him. And he's exactly right. There's an outpouring of emotion about this. The fact that you did not have a delay and uncertainty really has resulted in an enormous amount of trust and calm. There's a few complaints out there. We should have an outsider. We should have a process. But I think this actually is working out well for me.
But what about Joe's point about, you know, that William Gross is, you know, he is a Bostonian. He's a his entire career as a law enforcement official has been with the department he's about to lead. That, you know, maybe what Boston could have used is some different thinking, a fresh perspective, bold, as Joe's saying. But, like, there's just no opportunity for that. Continuity, yes, but stale thinking also, and the allegiances within the department, couldn't that be problematic?
Yeah, it can be. And I get the argument entirely. And yet I think in this particular case, having someone from Boston builds trust. And I think if there's anything missing in terms of policing, it has been the trust component. I think a lot of folks in the mayor's office probably think that the police department's working pretty effectively otherwise, but that there is that lack of trust, that lack of connection to the community.
So that's why this next topic that we're going to talk about really matters, because the Washington Post this week reported that Boston has the largest gap in the nation regarding arrest rates for homicides where there were white victims versus where there were black victims. Now, when a white victim is killed, suspects are arrested in nearly 90% of cases, according to the Post. Contrast that to the 42% of cases leading to an arrest where the homicide victim is black. And Mayor Marty Walsh told us this week that, in his view, the city has made some progress on this in recent years, but it's not enough.
Chief Gross, Commissioner Gross, will have to focus on that number and really work to get that number down, because family members who lose loved ones want to know who's responsible for taking the life of the loved one. And that's something that we have to continue to focus on.
Now, Joe, I want to start with you because I want to do a hat tip to the Herald, because the Herald reported a similar story back in 2014, finding just as large a gap in these homicide clearance rates. So it seems as if in that case, nothing has changed in 4 years since the Herald reported this. So what's your take?
In fact, I hate to say it to the mayor, but there has not been progress on this in the last 4 years. And in fact, I think the arrest rate was better 4 years ago for black murders than there are now, but roughly the same. So there really hasn't been progress on this. There might be different reasons for this. I don't think there's inherent just racism involved. I don't think the cops look at crimes and say, oh, we're going to get more priority to this person because it's white than this person who's black. But, you know, this goes to not just police, but to the media as well. Do the media pay attention to black-on-black murders as much as they do maybe a white person murdered? No, I don't think they do. So I think inherent there's a problem here where, you know, crimes in the city don't get paid attention to as much.
So on that point, we spoke with Wesley Lowery. He's the national correspondent for The Washington Post. He co-authored this story that the Post had on the homicide numbers. And he talked about this. There's about the perception gap, as he called it, in that he saw while doing this reporting.
There's an issue, this gulf between perception and reality, and in many cases, the perception being the reality, right? If black and brown members of the community do not believe you care about them or do not believe you care about their murders, no matter what the reason for that belief, it's going to make them less likely to cooperate, which is then going to make you even less likely to solve their murders.
Tom, what do you think?
I think the point's exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of potential explanations out there, code of silence and so on, that would cause for a difference in clearance rates. But the Washington Post study was that Boston was the worst. And it does start to feed into the whole question about Boston and how much do we really care, which is really what Joe's point was. We saw this tragic case in South Boston of a van hitting two children and killing them. You got to wonder if this had been in Mattapan, would there have been the same reaction to this? And it's been a huge reaction. And there is this is actually why I like Gross as a pick, because I think what Gross will bring to it is the sense that if there is, you know, hidden racism at play, that here's someone who's going to be willing to tackle that.
But you know what the DA, Michael Sullivan, said? I mean, he sort of pushed back when the Globe did its follow-up story and said that many of the circumstances under which black Bostonians are murdered are also circumstances, in Sullivan's view, that make the cases hard to solve. You know, he was talking about a lot of them being outdoor shootings that leave next to no evidence. And so you know, even if the, in the cases where the evidence is gathered, then getting those last pieces of the puzzle regarding people coming forward, that it's hard. So he's saying it's not racism, it's just the circumstances make it really difficult.
Yeah, I get that. But the question is, why is it so much more difficult in this city than it is in any other city in America?
And why is it so big, and why has it remained so big over the years and not improved at all? When, you know, crime-fighting techniques certainly have improved a lot in the last 4 or 5 years.
Right. You know, and then Wesley Lowery pointed out that that in their analysis of the recent numbers, there's also just the absolute difference in the number of Black Bostonians who are killed versus the much smaller number of
tiny
white victims.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like virtually single digits. Yeah. So there's that problem. One last thing about this. Let me just play another piece of tape. This is Mona Lisa Smith. She's the president of Mothers for Justice and Equality, and we talked to her. She founded this group after she lost her nephew to neighborhood violence in 2010.
What does those mothers and fathers and siblings and those left with the loss feel? Mm-hmm. And many of them feel that because of the enormity of the murders, because how this has become such a normalcy in the communities, and that there's no urgency of now being felt or happening, you know, when they lose their family members to the violence.
So that urgency that Mona Lisa is talking about, I just wanted to ask you guys, because in the Washington Post story, what I found interesting is they outlined some changes that Ed Davis made when he was a commissioner, that, you know, he sent a team off to London because they have a very good closure rate, I guess, there in their homicide cases, and brought back some best practices from there. They started the practice of assigning detectives to cases almost as soon as the crime is reported, things like that. So it does feel like there are really practical structural changes in policing that can be made. Are we seeing enough of that in Boston? Should we be seeing more?
Yes, we should. And this is why you get down to the selection of Gross as a commissioner, where is he going to do things the way things have been done already? Or is he going to bring a fresh new perspective to it? I hope he does bring a fresh new perspective to it and puts more of a focus on this issue.
Yeah, I'm fairly optimistic about Gross. I mean, I think you listen to the response to people on the street. They're excited about him. There's a sense it's a new day.
Mm. All right. So one more topic for this week's Week in Review. And this one, I've been shaking my head about it for many days now, because a Massachusetts congressional candidate misrepresents herself to Fox News.
Ann Kirkpatrick, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Tell us why you do support ICE.
I'm actually here to speak directly to Donald Trump. I feel that what's happening at the border is wrong. I'm a mother of four, and I believe that separating kids from their parents is illegal and inhumane. I'm actually Barbara Letalian. I'm a state senator representing a large immigrant community and running for Congress in Massachusetts.
Okay, so I'm going to play a little bit more, but here's what happened. Fox News actually was trying to book Ann Kirkpatrick, as you heard, a Democrat running for Congress in Arizona. They had a contact it was actually an outdated contact for a press person who now actually works for Barbara Letalian's campaign for Congress in the Massachusetts 3rd. So at airtime, Letalian appeared instead of Kirkpatrick.
Again, my name is Barbara Letalian, and I refuse to believe that our only options are open borders or traumatized.
All right.
Let's move along.
That didn't go as planned.
Second, so that's what happens sometimes. Time for a break?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now,
it doesn't really happen that much.
No, it doesn't happen that much. But there's one more twist here, because Desiree Dunn, executive producer for the show Fox and Friends First, told The Washington Post that their press contact, the one that they reached out to, had actually accepted the invitation on Kirkpatrick's behalf and actually followed with an email confirming the segment, which included background information and a campaign logo for Ann Kirkpatrick, meaning that this press person working for Barbara Letalian essentially lied to Fox News.
Yes.
And presumably Letalian knew.
Of course she did. Of course she did. And let's be honest about this. This was not Barbara Letalian trying to send a message to Donald Trump. This is Barbara Letalian trying to win a congressional race.
She's exactly.
She's running for Congress. She saw this as a huge opportunity to make a splash. I mean, like I said before, you know, these candidates are having trouble getting attention in this district. And there's like 11 different candidates. this could win her the election single-handedly, this incident. So don't tell me it was because to talk to Donald Trump. She knew what kind of a splash it was going to make. And that press person should not have a job anymore. I'm sorry. He lost all credibility. Yeah. And she knew what was going on.
But if the press person doesn't have a job, she shouldn't have a job.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you think it could really win her the election? I mean, like, they lied. You think so?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think we're completely in accord here. This is exactly the kind of stuff you look to break through. Now, I think it's going to backfire. I think what's going to happen is people are going to see this as just a lot of lying and not think a lot of Italian. But I think at the time, they believed this was a way to break out.
Okay, so it got her maybe a little more name and face recognition. It got her in the headlines. We're talking about her now. But I want to – Joe Katz is Italian spokesperson, and he's the one who used to work for Kirkpatrick. He explained his decision – well, the deception, we should call it, to the Globe this way. He said, Fox News is where you go when you want to talk to Donald Trump. And Barbara felt she had an obligation to her constituents to take advantage of that opportunity. And then he said, we showed the exact same commitment to truth, fairness, and accuracy that Fox News always has.
Which is essentially him admitting that he was lying.
Yeah, well, exactly. Right. But, you know, if you're trying to go aim for higher ground, why say that you're doing what Fox News does?
Exactly.
Well, he shouldn't have a job anymore. I mean, clearly, but you know, maybe this could help his career too. Who knows? People may look at it and say, "Oh, what a coup! You know, you got this big interview for your client that you know that Fox News wasn't even trying to talk to." So, and now, I mean, this was the lead story nationally on Yahoo News, a lot of different publications. This was leading the internet, and I do think it's going to help her congressional campaign.
We'll have to see. I don't know. I just come away with it thinking, you know, getting a boost from a congressional campaign through deception is just, maybe that's just politics. But just to be fair, Italian said in an interview with the Lowell Sun this week that they, being Fox, reached out to us. It was their lack of due diligence that enabled me to go on the show. There was an opportunity there and I took it. Well, I have to say, she's getting very good at political obfuscation, because if they sent an email back with Kirkpatrick's logo on it, I mean, what more due diligence is...
Yeah, she knew she was going to spring it on them as soon as the interview started. That was her whole goal.
I mean, it sounds like an ad, right? Yeah, when you actually listen to it. I'm Barbara Italian, and I'm running to represent the largest immigrant community and running for Congress in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
It was built for an ad.
It was a free ad for her.
Tom, the look on
your face. No, I mean, if she gets voted in as a consequence.
You were a congressional candidate one time, weren't you,
Tom? Yeah, I know. And my lying and cheating was far less than this.
You mean zero?
Zero.
Your line, yeah.
So if people vote her in after this, I really think it speaks very poorly of the people in that congressional district.
Well, they don't know. They just, a lot of people agree with her, thinking, oh, that's great. She spoke up against Donald Trump. I'm proud of her. I think a lot of people are going to view it as that. And they may not know the details of her deception or may not care about it. All they know is that she got on Fox News and gave it to Donald Trump.
No, you're right. But the last thing we need is more deceptive politicians.
Ah, amen to that. Okay, so we've got just a little bit of time, but enough left for our hubbubs. I haven't actually left enough time for hubbubs in a while, so I'm really happy to do this. Joe, you go first.
Why don't Tom go first, and then I'll come in with mine once I figure it out.
Okay, all right. So I have never understood why it costs as much to travel west on the turnpike at 3 p.m. as it does at 6 p.m. If we could cut prices for off-peak travel, maybe a few people would change the times they drive, reducing congestion for everyone else. Turns out the legislature agrees with me, and it proposed to test exactly that, a 25% cut in tolls for those traveling outside of rush hour. Governor Charlie Baker promptly vetoed the idea.
Good.
Saying he didn't think it would work.
Terrible idea.
It's a great idea. Notwithstanding that such congestion pricing is in place and works in cities around the world, that was the whole point of this experiment, to see if it actually would help cut traffic. Let me finish.
Go ahead.
I will not interrupt your hubbub. I'm promising you. Instead, Baker consigned this interesting idea to the worst of all possible fates, a governmental study. In other words, your commute next week will be as awful as it always was, and your government, afraid of change, is making sure it stays that way.
This was a sneaky way to try to raise tolls on the
turnpike. It is not, Joe.
That's what it was.
Oh, so your hubbub is disagreeing.
That's my hubbub.
The sneaky way to raise tolls. It was actually cutting tolls by 25% for off-peak travel.
I'm all for dynamic pricing. I mean, yeah. This is the 21st century, Joe. Come on.
And by the way, cities across the United States do it all the time. I mean, we are really behind the times.
They're doing it to increase revenues, though.
They do it actually to smooth out congestion. I mean, it really is. In Washington, D.C., I'm in D.C. all the time.
There's
it's
congestion.
Amazing.
If you've ever been on the turnpike at noon, it can be just as congested as it is at 5 o'clock. It's crazy.
It certainly can be, particularly during leaf peeping season. But, but in fact, I go on the pike a lot, and it is much more congested at rush hour than it is at noon.
Okay. You know, I'm hearing listeners out there yelling, why do we even have tolls on the pike anyway still?
Oh, because we need them. We need them to fund the big dig. I thought we all knew that.
All right. Honestly, that was my favorite hubbub we've ever done. Hubbub debate. We've never had that.
We really haven't. It's all just some nice community event that no one cares about.
Okay. All right. So, So my hubbub it has to do with me, even though I don't actually like, honestly, it's weird talking about myself, but it was in the news this week that this is really tough because I have two more weeks, technically, as Radio Boston host, because I've decided to move over to the other side of the building here at WBUR and sort of up the time slot to 10 o'clock to be one of the new hosts of On Point.
And You're going national.
It's been it's funny. Like, it's a great opportunity, and I'm really excited for it. But it's been incredibly bittersweet because I love this show.
The tears are flowing freely.
They have been, let me tell you. And I love doing what the three of us, the 10 of us actually, do every week, just talk about this community, this issue, have debates over, tolls on the pike. It's been like the best job I've ever had. So I'll leave it at that because I still am on the job for another couple of weeks. But we'll talk more about
that.
You're
going to do a great job.
Thanks. Can you see I can barely hold a sentence together now? What will the rest of America think? Boston's used to it. All right. That's my hubbub for the day. And let me say a great big thank you to Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political reporter and columnist and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you, Magda.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Always great to have you, Tom.
Thanks.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.